This podcast brought to you by Hope 103.2.
Welcome to the Hope Mornings Weekly Podcast. I'm Katrina Rowe. This week, with the G20 being held in Brisbane, we catch up with Mica Challenge about a protest they did that's making waves around the world. International affairs commentator Dr. Keith Suter reflects on 25 years since the Berlin Wall came down, including the role that Christians played in ending the Soviet dominance. For the first time in 2014, Aussie men are less stressed than Aussie women. We'll find out why. Joanna Hayes from Celibate in the City discusses the comments made by TV mum Julie Bowen from Modern Family that your 20s are a time to make your relationship mistakes. Should we let our kids just cry it out? Should we ignore their tantrums? What do you do if your little one melts down in the supermarket? Dr. Justin Colson addresses the commonly held approaches to toddler cries and tantrums. Simon Smart from the Centre for Public Christianity was thoroughly taken with Marion Cotillard in the new French film, 2 Days, 1 Night. And we catch up with New South Wales finalist for Senior Australian of the Year, author Jackie French, who talks about her childhood struggle with dyslexia and how it's actually helped her to write over 150 books. That's all coming up in the Hope Mornings Weekly Podcast. Don't forget you can download it from the Hope 103.2 website or subscribe on iTunes. Just search for Hope Media and select the Hope Mornings Weekly Podcast. I'm Katrina Rowe. Thanks for listening. Over the weekend, Mica Challenge enjoyed a moment in the spotlight, highlighting the impact that tax evasion has on the world's poor ahead of the G20. Around $160 million is robbed from developing nations through tax evasion. John Beckett is the national coordinator of the Mica Challenge campaign, a global movement of Christians speaking out against poverty and injustice. Hi, John.
Hi.
Tell us about your protest. What did you do?
Yeah, down in the centre of Brisbane on Saturday, and so about 150 of us, and we dressed up in suits and board shorts, so party on the top, business down the bottom.
Yeah.
And, just basically deck chairs, mocktails, palm trees, set up a fake beach in the middle of Brisbane and trying to highlight this issue that you mentioned. And just to correct you a little bit, was not 160 million, but 160 billion, actually.
That when I said it, I thought that doesn't sound like enough because I'm sure it's more than that. So, yeah, 160 billion, that makes more sense. But I understand you got quite a lot of media coverage because you were the first G20 protest, is that right?
Yeah, two things really. One was that we were the first official protest and we'd been working closely with the police and the government up here just to make sure that that was constructive. But a lot of the press contrasted the nature of our protest with the protests that everybody's worried about up here in Brisbane and around the world. And so the idea that we were a bunch of Christians and the idea that we had a constructive process that was trying to get a message across rather than just make a nuisance was a big part of what they reported on up here.
So the G20 often does attract riots and violence and real trouble, doesn't it?
You can see it. I'm up here at the moment and the world's eyes are on this place. The media's arriving, there are people coming in the airport all the time, and it is a place where your message gets across. It's a place, this is a table where some of the most important decisions are made in our world and they affect billions of people. So it is a time to get your message heard.
Yeah, and so let's talk about that message. How much are developing nations being impacted by tax dodging?
As I said, the figures, it's a very conservative estimate, $160 billion. We think it's just the tip of the iceberg. There are stories that have come out in the last couple of days and the last couple of weeks about this problem of multinational companies shifting their profits all around the world. And basically, it just means that they don't pay tax where they do their economic activity. And in developing nations where they don't have the capacity to hunt these people down, it means that the citizens bear the burden of that and they have to pay their taxes. But these companies are using the infrastructure, the education, et cetera, that the country provides. But then they're not giving anything back. And so people miss out on essential services like healthcare and education and water. They're the things that help nations lift themselves out of poverty.
Yeah. Is it true that poor nations could be losing more money through tax dodging than what they actually get through foreign aid?
Yeah, it is true. That $160 billion is more than those collective nations received in aid a couple of years ago. So that is a major issue. We've got a guy up here, Ephraim Tendero, who heads up a group of about 30,000 churches in the Philippines. It's been a privilege to have him here. And he was saying that it's a year on from Typhoon Haiyan, and they'd been given about $800 million in aid and support from around the world, which he's very thankful for. But in the same time, they've had to take out a $3 billion loan from the World Bank. And so they just can't rebuild their country when they don't have the tax base that they need to do it internally. And this problem of multinational tax dodging means that they're not getting the money in from the companies who are operating within their borders that they should be getting, so they can't move forward. In Africa, the latest estimate by the World Bank is that for every dollar that comes in, $3 flows out. So it's simple maths. If you get $1, that's great. But if you take three away, you're minus two.
Yeah.
So the, you know, they're saying, well, thank you for the aid. We need it to rebuild. But if you give us $1, then leave the three here that you should be leaving here, then we've got $4 and we can make our countries prosper.
So, John, how would you like this issue to be addressed at the G20? What could happen to actually change this?
Well, it's both here in Australia that we're calling on our government, so Joe Hockey and Tony Abbott in particular, to do some things, and also the G20. Three things that we're asking for. The main one, really, is that we're asking for governments to require companies to report all the payments that they make and receive in every country where they operate. Basically, at the moment, they're only required to tell us what's happening globally within their companies. And these multinational companies, now more than 50% of all world trade happens within companies rather than between companies, if that makes sense. So these companies just shift money internally and they can move it anywhere they want in the world. We actually can't see where the money's moving. And so this would just require companies to tell us where the money's going. And if we get some more information, we shine a light on the issue, then we can really start to deal with the details of it.
Thank you, John, for filling us in.
Yeah, great.
And all the best with your protests.
Yeah, thanks so much. And if people want to get involved, that would be great. Just shinethelight.com.au, and there's plenty of ways that people can still add their voice to try and get this over the line.
Okay. Thanks, John.
Thanks.
John Beckett is the National Coordinator of the Mica Challenge Campaign. I'll put a photo of their protest up on the Hope 1032 Facebook page and shinethelight.com.au. The people of Germany are celebrating today as they mark 25 years since the fall of the Berlin Wall. For 28 years, the city was divided and loved ones were cut off from each other. But the wall coming down, it's not just a historic event, it's also a symbol of hope for people living in oppressive states everywhere, evidence that things can get better. Keith Suter, our international affairs commentator, is on the line and I think he's happy to have a good news story to discuss for once. Hi, Keith.
Good morning. Hello.
Yeah, well, people my age, we can remember the wall coming down, but we don't remember it going up. So can you just explain a little bit about what happened in the aftermath of World War II that led to the Berlin Wall going up in the first place?
Well, it actually goes back to World War I, and we're commemorating this year the outbreak of World War I. World War I ended with Germany defeated but not occupied, and that meant that we planted the seeds, really, for World War II. Mm-hmm. During World War II, the Allied leaders decided that this time Germany had to be destroyed and smashed up. And so Germany, in 1945, at the end of World War II, was then divided by the four major countries, so the Soviet Union, the United Kingdom, United States, and France. And they were then occupied. And so you had an East Germany controlled by the Soviets and a Western Germany controlled by these other three Western countries, US, UK, and France. So we had an Iron Curtain that went up from 1945 onwards. And then deep inside Eastern Germany, you had the capital city of Berlin, which itself was divided into those four zones. Now, it meant, therefore, that if you were living in Eastern Germany, or anywhere really in Eastern Europe, and you wanted to flee to the West, one way of doing that would be to get into West Berlin and then catching a plane from West Berlin and getting into Western Europe and therefore to be free.
So it was sort of partly about stopping people from escaping.
Absolutely. That was the sole reason it was put up in 1961. Okay. So many people was trying to flee Eastern Europe. Now, the official explanation from Moscow is that it was to stop the Westerners trying to get into East Berlin.
But it was so fabulous in there.
There was to stop them from getting out. And it was a really vicious construction. I'd been through it on a number of occasions during the old Cold War years, and it was really a formidable structure. But then the whole of the Iron Curtain, which ran right the way dividing Eastern Europe from Western Europe, was also very formidable. The barbed wire, by the way, came from France. Soviet barbed wire wasn't good enough, so the Soviets bought the barbed wire from France for that original Iron Curtain that ran down throughout the whole of Eastern Europe. It's worth bearing in mind that throughout all of the period of the Soviet occupation, there were always groups trying to break away for freedom. And it was really only when you come to 25 years ago that clearly the Soviet control over Eastern Europe really wasn't working. It was falling apart. And so the people power behind the Iron Curtain, including in East Berlin, were sufficient then to end the Cold War, because the Soviet Union simply ran out of capacity to control people. What is interesting is now reading the archives of the KGB, they had no way of knowing that the Berlin Wall was going to come down. Similarly, by looks of it, CIA and the British intelligence, they didn't get it right either. Everybody was caught by surprise. I'd been in Berlin only a few months earlier. I was taken by surprise. Yeah. I'm in good company, along with the KGB and the CIA.
And so looking back now, you know, what was the significance and of that actually happening, and how did it change things?
I think it was one of the turning points of the world history for the 20th century, in the sense that it showed the importance of the ordinary person maintaining their optimism in the belief that ultimately they could shrug off the Soviet control over their bit of the world, be it either in Germany or Poland or Hungary, Romania, etc. That element of optimism. Secondly, of course, the role of the churches. I travelled extensively behind the Iron Curtain, and there were always flourishing Christian groups operating there. They say the church works best when it's under oppression. It's interesting to note that at the height of the Cold War, on a per capita basis, more people were in church in Moscow than in London. So the Christian groups are really very important in all of this. And of course, the trigger before the conflict in Berlin, but a few weeks earlier, the trigger had been the persecution of Christians out in Hungary. And it was the rebellion there that led to this fragmentation, rapid fragmentation of the Soviet control over Eastern Europe. So the Christians played a key role in helping to end the Cold War.
Nice to have a rare good news story in the world of international politics, something to celebrate certainly today.
And it's a celebration of hope. And also, you've got to bear in mind, the world is now a safer place than it was, say, 100 years ago. Fewer wars, fewer people being killed in wars. People are safer, living longer, living better today than they would have been 100 years ago.
Yeah. Well, this is just one example of some positive change as well.
Absolutely.
So. Thanks, Keith.
Thank you.
That's international affairs commentator Keith Suter, celebrating 25 years since the fall of the Berlin Wall. We hear so much more about male depression these days that I was very surprised to hear the results of a new survey by the Australian Psychological Society. Aussie men actually have higher levels of well-being and lower levels of stress than women. 2014 was the first time in the annual survey that women have been more stressed out than men. It's National Psychology Week. Amanda Gordon is a clinical psychologist, and she's the founder of National Psychology Week for the Australian Psychological Society. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Katrina.
Now, this is the first time that men have been happier than women. What's changed for men?
I don't know whether things have particularly changed for men, in that compared to last year and previous years, I don't think the levels of well-being have increased across the board, nor have our levels of stress diminished. But what we're finding is the gender differential for the first time, whereby women are actually feeling worse, have lower levels of well-being than men do.
So it's not necessarily that men are getting better, it's that women are getting more stressed.
It seems that way from this particular survey, yes.
Okay. I was wondering if men were getting more skilled in dealing with their stress. I was hoping we might be hearing something like that.
Yeah, we've always heard in the past that women do have more resources and are better able to deal with stress, and that's why they manage better when there are difficulties. But it doesn't seem to be the case currently in Australian society, which is very distressing for researchers who hope that, as you say, that men would be getting better at it, and that's the issue. But across the board, we're not feeling better than we were last year.
Oh, that's disappointing. What are women stressed about?
Well, the biggest thing seemed to be personal finances, which I thought was interesting when you compare it to men, who also are worried about it, but not at the same level. And then the next things are family issues. And they also seem to be quite concerned about maintaining a healthy lifestyle, maintaining their mental health and their physical health.
Mm.
And that seems to be across the board. They're the sorts of things that people do worry about.
Yeah, there's a lot of pressure on women trying to do it all these days. What are some steps to managing stress more effectively?
Well, there are some really important things that work. The strange thing to hear from a psychologist, the thing we know that works the best is a regular exercise routine.
Mm.
So don't say, I'm too busy, I can't do that, because that will help your mental health as well as your physical health. The next thing that's important is engage in an active relaxation strategy. So it can be something like a yoga class or going for a gentle walk or actively listening to some music, not just vegging in front of the TV, which is not an active engagement and therefore won't actually reduce your stress levels. It might be that you avoid dealing with things while you're watching TV, but you won't be actively reducing your stress.
Mm.
And one of the other really important things is talking to others, but talking to people who care about you and will listen to you, but don't necessarily have to feel as badly as you're feeling at the moment. It can bring you up. You know, there are some families you see that when one person is down, everyone else gets down. Whereas in healthy relationships, we find that when one person is feeling down, the others can sort of pick them up a bit and help them through so that they can cope with things better. So find people in your life who can do that for you.
Mm, that's easier said than done, isn't it?
Well, just work on those relationships.
Yeah.
Work on all your relationships and make sure you do that for your friends as well. When you're doing it for your friends or family members, they'll be better at doing it for you. But also, if that's not working, if it becomes chronic, if it's happening that you're feeling stressed or distressed over a period of time, don't just live with it. Go and seek professional help. It's National Psychology Week. We want people to know that there is no stigma attached to going to the best resourced people to help you manage stress, depression, anxiety, and that's psychologists. We are available, accessible. You can go to your GP and talk to your GP and perhaps get a referral, or you can go directly to a psychologist. And we're not talking about long-term therapy. For many people, getting some resources through a psychologist can be a relatively short-term process and can help them manage either the acute situation that's led to their stress right now or manage themselves so they don't get into a funk when something happens.
Mm. All right. Well, thanks for having a chat with us this morning, Amanda.
You're very welcome.
That's Amanda Gordon from the Australian...
Happy National Psychology Week.
Yes, that's National Psychology Week, and Amanda's from the Australian Psychological Society. You're listening to the Hope Mornings Weekly Podcast. If you haven't yet, be sure to subscribe on iTunes to enjoy a new episode in your inbox every Friday afternoon. Still to come, Simon Smart reviews 2 days, one night, and we catch up with the New South Wales finalist for Senior Australian of the Year, Jackie French. Well, Modern Family star Julie Bowen, who plays the mum on Modern Family, has been in the news because she has been supporting her TV daughter, Sarah Hyland, who's getting out of an abusive relationship at the moment. And Julie Bowen has been making comments that she says, I personally made a million dating mistakes when I was young, and that your 20s are really a chance to make those mistakes. And so I've got Joanna Hayes from Celibate in the City on the line. She's in her 20s. Joanna, do you agree with this comment that your 20s are for making mistakes?
I think it's the perfect decade to make mistakes.
Yeah.
And you're going to make a lot of them. Like, you know, you're becoming an adult. It's the time when you make a lot of decisions anyway. So it makes a lot of sense that those would often involve some mistakes as well. And you don't have a lifetime's worth of experience to draw on, and none of us are perfect. So, yeah, I think it's the prime decade for making a lot of mistakes.
Do you think that it's important not to be afraid of making mistakes?
Oh, absolutely. Like, I think we can get paranoid about it to the point of just saying no to everything and never trying anything and just saying no, 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 no. But I think there's a lot to be said for just giving it a go. So that guy that asks you out that you're not sure if you like him at all or not, guess what? It's just a date. It's just a date. You could get to know him a little bit. And, hey, it might be an embarrassing disaster or it might be the start of something surprising. But if you just say no from fear of making a mistake, you're going to miss out on that learning experience.
That was me. I just said no to everything.
Yeah.
I kind of wish that I had been a little bit more brave and been a bit more open-minded, particularly with dating, I think, about considering people that maybe didn't fit my little
perfect box of lists and things like that. So,
yes, absolutely. It's funny, like, I know quite a few people who in their early 20s are sort of 10-year plan kind of people, and they would so rigorously stick to what they had decided at 19 was what they wanted to do for the next 10 years, that they missed out on a lot of stuff. And yep, they may not have made many mistakes, but they also didn't experience much at all. And also, if the things that they had planned didn't work out perfectly, there was this massive crushing sense of disappointment because they had that perfect plan and it didn't work.
So there's kind of this balance then between not being scared to make any mistakes, but also you don't want to live life filled with regrets because, you know, you had no wisdom. So what's a way of trying to protect a little bit from being a train wreck in your 20s? You know, if we're saying, well, be courageous, don't be afraid to make mistakes, particularly when it comes to dating.
Yeah.
But we don't want to end up as train wrecks either. So,
yeah.
Got any thoughts on that, Joanna?
Absolutely. Yeah, so I think the further through my 20s that I've got, the more I've appreciated two bits of advice. One is to learn from your elders. I learn from the mistakes of others. The Book of Proverbs is really useful on this point, and just thinking about observing the ways of the world, observing what happens for other people. And yeah, it can be really useful just to think about, oh, that's interesting that, you know, this particular friend was in that relationship and it went in this direction and it seemed to for these reasons. And just paying attention to what's happening around you and learning from the mistakes of others can help you a little bit with your own. And I think the second piece of advice that I used to just hate, but has become more and more useful, and I've seen its usefulness more the older I've got, is to consider the future. So a lot of the mistakes that you can make in your 20s are simply by not thinking beyond the next year or week. And so, for example, a lot of the mistakes we can make in our 20s are financial mistakes because we haven't sat down and thought, well, I would actually like to be able to own a house in my 30s, for example. Mm. And so we can make decisions about money in our 20s as though we're not living beyond 28, you know? Or like my dad in particular was really useful, even just in terms of work, of saying, like, make lists of achievements that you've made so that when you're applying for your next job, you already have that information. And, like, on the one hand, it's quite a simple thing, but part of the reason that it's wise is because he's thinking about it in terms of, yeah, you're going to have jobs in the future and you can actually prepare yourself now for ways to deal with that situation. So. Yeah. Yeah, thinking about the future a little bit more than I used to.
Oh, you might be approaching your 30s, Joanna. That sounds like...
I might be getting sensible.
That's a very non-20 way of thinking, so...
Yes. And All right. That's the thing, you can say it to 22-year-olds and they won't listen, but we can try.
All right, thank you, Joanna. It's amazing the difference that 7 years can make. Or 5 years even, anyway. In your 20s, 5 years is a long time of growing up.
It really is.
Yes. Joanna Hayes from Celibate in the City. We're talking about your 20s and, yes, the idea of making a few mistakes in your 20s is really quite okay. The beguiling French actress Marion Cotillard is the star of a new drama called 2 Days, One Night. You might remember her from movies like Inception or Midnight in Paris. She somehow manages to tone down her normally glamorous looks to play the part of a factory worker fighting to keep her job. Simon Smart from the Centre for Public Christianity was rather taken with this movie, weren't you, Simon?
I was. It's a very affecting movie. It's one of those ones that you kind of not sure what to expect. It's not high budget. It's kind of basic in lots of ways, but it's the acting and the storytelling that's sublime. Okay. Very well told.
Well, in this movie, really, one person's life becomes hugely affected by the moral choices of those around them. Can you explain the scenario that she finds herself in?
Yeah, so if you can believe it, she's a factory worker, and due to a really awful boss, she finds herself in a situation where she's going to be made redundant and her workmates will receive a 1,000 euro bonus as part of that package. Now, she's had depression, she had a bit of a breakdown, and she's coming back from that, but then this is presented with this situation. So they convince, a friend of hers convinces the factory boss to hold a vote. Either they get their bonus or she gets a job, but not the two. And so she has a weekend to go around to each of her workmates and try to convince them to vote for her to keep her job, which will mean them losing their bonus. So that's the setup. And you see these portraits of everyone's different lives as she goes around and tries to convince them.
Okay, so is the film basically made up of sort of her conversations as she visits these people and tries to convince them to have pity, to have mercy on her, really?
Yes, and it does. And so these are portraits of their lives. And these are people who cannot afford to give up this bonus. That's the point. They're struggling people. They're in lives where they're barely making ends meet. They've got kids in schools and their bills they need to pay and they're struggling. And so for them, it actually would be a cost to vote for her. And yet you've got this incredibly vulnerable person who's wanting, just as you said, mercy for her and grace to vote for her and let her stay off the dole, come back, get her life back in order. And so it presents a very interesting kind of ethical dilemma.
Yeah, and does it do a good job of exploring those kind of questions?
Oh, yeah, it really does. I mean, you see the people's, some who are just completely and utterly selfish and a bit brutal, actually, about their choice. There's no way they're going to give up their money. Others who are racked with, their conscience is racked with this. They probably sense that it's the right thing to do, but they're going to choose for themselves over her. And then others who just see very, very clearly that the voting for her is the right thing to do, and even though it's costly, that's what they'll end up choosing.
Okay, so would you recommend this film, Simon?
I would. It's, again, it's not a blockbuster type of film, but if you're interested in films that really plumb into complex ethical questions, films that are very convincing, like you forget you're watching a film. It's so well acted. You're absorbed into the story. And it does really present the question around ethics and what governs our choices in a way that lots of other films probably don't. So, yeah, I would recommend this one.
It sounds like one you'd come out of the cinema and be thinking about it for a while afterwards.
Be a good one to go with friends and then discuss afterwards, that type of film.
Okay. And Marion Cotillard, you did find her convincing as a factory worker? Because, I mean, she's a very beautiful woman.
She is. Completely convincing. Yeah. They play down the glamour. There's no makeup. She wears kind of very ordinary clothes. So you do feel like it's a convincing portrayal.
Yeah.
And she is just, she portrays a vulnerable person in a very, very convincing fashion.
Yeah, sounds good.
I think she'll get lots of raps for this acting.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Simon. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah, thanks, Katrina.
That's Simon Smart. We've been talking about 2 Days, 1 Night, starring Marion Cotillard. And, that's at the movies now. The Australian of the Year nominations are out for 2015. And for New South Wales, the finalist was Deborah Lee Furness, the child advocate and adoption campaigner. The Young Australian of the Year was Genevieve Clay-Smith, the filmmaker and social entrepreneur. But the Senior Australian of the Year was Jackie French, the very prolific author who's written more than 150 books in her lifetime. But what you may not know about Jackie is how much she struggled as a child because of her dyslexia. So I caught up with Jackie and asked her how dyslexia affected her schoolwork when she was a kid.
You know, clearly I learnt to read before I went to school, because I'm pretty sure that in the school system both then and now, I never would have learnt to read. With my form of dyslexia, trying to follow a line with a finger and any page with only a few words on it makes me feel actually quite sick. I really can't focus on it at all. When I read, I tend to scan a page. I couldn't even read Run, Spot, Run, but my teacher found that I'd illegally snuck into the library at lunchtime and was gulping my way through Black Beauty. Very thick book, small print, words on the page. And I remember standing above me with a headmistress, and they were discussing how could a kid who couldn't read a single word on the blackboard obviously be reading and understanding Black Beauty. Most of my schooling was fine. I was very, very blessed with most of my teachers. They realised very quickly that I was trying. They realised I wasn't stupid, partly because I could tell stories. But there were a few teachers who, well, it was pretty hellish. They assumed that a kid who was obviously bright but couldn't, say, do arithmetic properly, kept on making mistakes, couldn't spell, that I just wasn't trying, that I was daydreaming. There was one teacher who I still remember with dread, Miss Bonnie. And I think every day my hands were red with her, just beating them with a ruler time after time after time when I made a mistake. But most of my teachers ranged from wonderful to unbelievably superb beyond the call of duty. And this, of course, was in the days when no one really understood. Well, certainly no one had heard of dyslexia. But even now, very few people understand how varied it is. Dyslexia is really a catchphrase for 1,001 or more different problems that a kid might have which prevent them reading and doing arithmetic as easily as the rest of their classmates. And ironically, often these kids are more intelligent, not less. So it takes longer for a dyslexic kid to get there, but once they have got there, they often just zoom off. But unfortunately, it's so easy to teach a kid they're dumb, and those scars last all their lives.
Well, I have one friend with dyslexia who I went through primary school with, who probably has struggled a little bit with study, didn't complete his university studies, but is incredibly bright and incredibly good conversationalist. I find it sad in a way that he hasn't had the same opportunities that he would have had if he hadn't had this difficulty.
Yes, and one of the enormous tragedies is that so little is still done for kids with dyslexia. In so many schools, they leave it to volunteers. If a kid needed a dentist, you wouldn't call in a parent and say, okay, we're going to give the parents 3 days training, now fill the kid's teeth. Kids have the right to be taught to read by professionals, and every school has the duty to provide qualified professionals to teach kids to read in the manner that they need. You can't just fob it off on semi-trained volunteers. Now, look, volunteers do a brilliant job. I'm certainly not saying don't use them. I'm certainly not saying the Reading Buddy scheme isn't wonderful. It is wonderful. But we also need in every school that kids who learn differently, not kids who are necessarily slow learners, but who learn differently, need every day to have someone to teach them in different ways to read and to learn to focus on things.
Do you think that your own experience with dyslexia has nurtured in you an even stronger passion for helping kids to read?
Very much so, but also it's very strongly hereditary. So I've seen it in my own family as well and in other families, quite how deep the scars can go with kids who are not dumb and yet often are fobbed off. So often parents are told, oh, well, don't worry, kids learn to read at different rates, and the kids are 6 or 7 or 8 or 9, and the parents and the kids know there is a problem. And yet the schools really are just still fobbing them off. But with adults too, there's a classic thing that adults who can't read well say, and that is, oh, I've forgotten my glasses, can you read this for me? And I've learnt now when someone says that to me to actually bring up the fact that I'm dyslexic and hold on a minute, I might have a bit of a problem too if it's only a few words on a page or a menu. It may be really hard for me to focus. So many adults, again, incredibly bright adults and often ones who are incredibly successful in other areas, still have problems reading because they were never taught to read properly.
Okay. And does dyslexia still affect you in your adult life?
Well, yes. Partly, I don't think I could have written 150, 160 books if I hadn't been dyslexic.
Why is that?
Well, it means when I read, I scan a page. It means I read faster than anyone I know. I absorb the data on that page, and I write very, very quickly too. However, it does mean that I can't spell, and not only can I not spell, but when I read it back, I don't even notice that I haven't spelled properly. So I do have someone now who does go through my work before it goes to the publishers, which the publishers are very grateful for because they don't have to decipher it. So for me, spelling is still, well, not just optional. There's not even an option. No one can read my handwriting, including me, but we've got computers these days. Computers can write for you. Computers can write neatly for you. Computers can correct your spelling. However, possibly one of the best things you can do for a kid who is dyslexic is teach them touch typing and give them a laptop. Ironically, you see, when you learn to read, you've got to learn to form the letters, focus on the page, as well as read. If you've got a laptop computer and you can touch type, you don't have to worry about focusing on the page because you're not looking at it. Learning to write on a laptop is so much easier than learning to write on a page. I know it sounds rather back the front, but if you teach a kid to write on a laptop, then they'll be learning to read at the same time. It's not a cure-all for dyslexia, but it's possibly one of the single most important things that a parent can do for a child, apart from asking the school to get a learning support teacher who is qualified to help the kids learn to read and catch up with their literacy and their numeracy.
Okay. Well, before I let you go, there is just one other way in which your dyslexia may have influenced your phenomenally successful career, and that was the very first manuscript you ever sent off.
Yes, that's true. I would probably not be a professional author now if I wasn't dyslexic. It was a very messy manuscript. There were no E's in it, except written in Enviro, because the wombat left the droppings on my typewriter. Not that E's didn't work. And it was picked out of the slush pile because it was so messy and so badly spelled, and they thought it would be unintentionally hilarious. And the editor read a bit aloud so everyone could giggle at it. And she read the first paragraph, she read the second paragraph, and then there in the office she read the entire story aloud. And 3 weeks later, they'd offered me in advance to publish it. But if I hadn't been dyslexic, and in fact if the wombat hadn't left his droppings on the typewriter, they may not have picked it out of the slush pile. And I think if that hadn't been accepted, I probably would have believed everyone who said, no, no, dear, you cannot be a writer in Australia. It is a waste of time ever send anything to a publisher.
So maybe you do have a lot to thank wombats for after all.
I do. I think I'm very, very grateful for both dyslexia and wombats. I certainly wouldn't be here if it wasn't for both of them.
Oh, fantastic. Thanks so much for taking the time to have a chat today.
My absolute pleasure.
I've been speaking with children's author Jackie French about her experience of dyslexia. Jackie is the New South Wales finalist for the 2015 Senior Australian of the Year.
Thanks for listening. Start your day with Life Words. Subscribe to Hope 1032's free daily email devotional at hope1032.com.au.